Yeah, it's not exactly you get to be my age. I'm actually 1 year younger than Paul was, and I go to bed pretty early. So when I'm heading for the gym, and I think at 6:50 or whatever it was this morning, to get probably 6, 7, 8 texts from people all over the country, kind of talks about what you're talking about. Not only that, we as teammates of Paul, and you know, I came to the big leagues in 1965, the first year Paul got to the big leagues, and so we were kind of rookies together. We played in our first World Series the next year. We, you know, then became one of the best teams in baseball, 109, 108, 101 games, 69, 70, 71. So you kind of internalize something like this. And, you know, we lost Mike Flanagan 2 years ago, and Dave McNally and Mike Cuellar and Mark Belanger. I mean, there's a litany of players. And, you know, you can, John, always talk about, well, that's part of growing old, but boy, it's hard to miss those kind of people. But it's certainly not hard to remember all the great times we had together.
Let's see if we can bring a couple of smiles to some faces. The recurring point all day today has been how well Paul Blair patrolled center field. He played shallow because he could. When you were on the mound, how confident were you that he could get to any ball that stayed in the ballpark?
Well, I don't think there was a better outfielder going back. And as you mentioned, he did play shallow. Now, you know, I had the love-hate relationship with Earl Weaver. Earl Weaver liked his outfielders to play deep. And the reason for that was that most outfielders, and of course Paul Blair with his 8 gold gloves wasn't most outfielders, most guys do come in better than they go back. So there would always be those moments when Paul would be playing shallow and somebody hit a ball up the gap. It might happen 2-3 times a year, and then Earl would read him the riot act when he get back to the dugout, and then the next inning would start, he'd go out to center field, and he'd be just as shallow as ever. So he certainly knew his strengths. I still, in my mind's eye, can remember a ball that Roy White of the Yankees hit. He hit a crisp line drive that was destined to go over the right center field bullpen in Memorial Stadium. And Paul, as you mentioned, playing very shallow, that galloped to deep left center field. And I'm not talking about a fly ball. I'm talking about a line drive. And he caught the ball, and it was like a butterfly hitting the fence. I saw Paul play down in Puerto Rico when I hurt my shoulder in 1969, and a lot of the parks there did not have warning tracks, and he would never hit a wall. He just had that innate sense to know where the fence was, to be able to have great vertical leaping ability. You see the class of Brian Downing and Freddie Lynn run into the fence. Well, Paul didn't do that. He somehow knew where the wall was, could go up and deftly reach over, catch balls that, to be quite frankly, nobody in the American League could do. There was no better center fielder from 1965 till really into the 70s, and I guess the 8 gold gloves testify to that.
Jim, let's go back to the 66 World Series. Paul shared with me a few years ago in an interview how that final catch that he made in the 66 World Series would be how he wanted to be remembered. Take us to that moment in the game. I know you pitched game 2 in the series, so you weren't on the field for that last out, but where were you, and explain your feeling when Paul Blair caught that final out?
Well, the whole 1966 World Series was surreal. It was Frank Robinson's first year. He comes over. Apparently, Cincinnati thought he was an old 30. He comes over, hits 49 home runs in the regular season, wins the Triple Crown, most valuable player in the American League. He would hit the home run in that 1-0 victory. And I think people forget. I mean, you can talk all you want. I mean, I was just sitting on the bench hoping that in a 1-0 ball game, because this was Drysdale, McNally. Dave started game 1, didn't pitch well. Drysdale gave up back-to-back home runs to Brooks and Frank Robinson in the first inning. We're just hoping with a 1-0 lead, and that's the way you kind of had to beat the Dodgers. Game 3 and 4 were 1-0 ball games. I got all the runs in game 2. I got 6 runs because of the errors by Willie Davis in center field for the Dodgers. But we're just hoping that the ball would stay in the ballpark, and it did. And, you know, I think, it was my first World Series, and I didn't realize, John, how difficult it is to win World Series. We won the first game. Mo Drabowski came in, struck out 11 Dodgers in 6 2/3 innings. I pitched my first shutout ever at the major league level in game 2. And then Wally Bunker, who had been rookie of the year in 1964, had some arm problems. He wins 1-0 over Osteen. Paul Blair hits the solo home run to win it 1-0. And then Frank, the solo home run off the Drysdale. And Paul catches that ball in center field, and then you realize for the first time in your career, you're world champions.
By the way, I looked it up. That home run from Paul Blair in game 3, 430 feet. What a shot.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think a lot of people, I think because we had so many outstanding defensive players, you go back, Brooks Robinson won 16 consecutive gold gloves. Mark Belanger, I think, won 8. Paul won 8, 7 in a row, I think from, 69 all the way through 75 or 76. But people that really know baseball, people that are Oriole fans, I think remember 1969. Everybody talks about when you come to the major leagues, you need 1,500 to 2,000 at-bats. Well, that kind of happened in 1969. And going into September, Paul was on a pace to hit 30 home runs. He was hitting well over 300, on a pace to hit driving over 100 runs. And in the words of late Mike Flanagan, sometimes you try a little bit too hard. And again, on that ball club, John, we had a big lead. And if some of the veteran players, Frank Robinson particularly, who nicknamed Paul Motor Mouth because Paul talked a lot, knew you wanted to hit 300 or win 20 games, they were going to remind you. So it was every time he'd go to home plate, don't think about tomatoes, because that was 300. That was 30 home runs. That was 100 RBIs. And Paul arguably was probably our most valuable player in 1969. And if he had had a good month of September, anywhere close to April, May, June, July, or August, he might have been the most valuable player in the American League. That's the kind of year he had. And then there was the tragic beating that afternoon game in Anaheim the next year. And in one split second, his career changed. And I think people, again, just because of his prowess of being one of the best center fielders ever to play the game, they forget until that beating from Ken Tatum, he was going to be one of the best players ever.
Do you think that changed his offensive ability when he got hit?
Well, he did. And Paul was deathly afraid of not being hit in the face. Who wouldn't be? But he did not like to get hit. But yet he was the best breaking ball hitter. So, you know, years probably, I don't know, maybe 5-6 years ago, we're, you know, celebrating something at Camden Yards. And I said, well, if you were deathly afraid of getting hit, how come you are a best breaking ball hitter? And he said, well, I used to look for it. And the minute he got beamed, he couldn't look for the breaking ball anymore because of that fastball off of Tatum had this fastball that ran maybe a foot to 18 inches, and he might have been looking breaking ball down and away, and the ball just ran up and in. And again, in that split second, his career changed. And he was still a marvelous player, but never as good as he was as far as being a great offensive and a great defensive player.
We're speaking with Orioles great Hall of Famer Jim Palmer. Jim, I also heard Paul Blair share a comment that our good friend Rex Barney would always preach here on WBAL Radio. Pitching and defense win games. During that interview that I had with him at the 40th anniversary of the 66 team, it was at Morgan State here in Baltimore, Paul Blair told me that he thought the game had changed in that respect, that now it's all about hitting. If you can't hit, it doesn't matter how good you can field. Do you share that observation?
Well, I think that's changed a little bit. I think there was a period in the game, if you go from 88, maybe 89, all the way till 2005, when they started testing for steroids. I think the game was about cartoon characters coming up to home plate and, you know, smaller ballpark, maybe tighter strike zones. But the game has changed. I mean, if you go back and look at the 2013 version of the Orioles, maybe one of the best defensive teams ever. I mean, talking about the whole field. So I think defense has been rekindled, and the fact that they're testing now and you have to play an honest game, I think you're kind of getting back to the mantra that we had. Yeah, it was pitching and defense, and as Earl Weaver used to say, it's nice to, because again, you got to remember how good a hitter Paul Blair was. He was, you know, along with Boog and Frank and Brooks and you know, Redeman and Don Buford, the best leadoff guys. He played on one of the greatest teams that ever suited up for three consecutive years. How often do you get to play for a team that wins 109 and 69 and then 108 and 101 games in three successive seasons? So somebody called earlier today and I said, you know, I never would have got to Cooperstown if it wasn't for Paul Blair. So it's part of growing old, but I'm going to miss him. And, you know, the other thing, John, is that, you know, while we were really tight on the field and everybody was friends and we had a lot of success, some of our best our best moments together is when maybe 8 or 10 of us would show up at Pine Ridge or Turf Valley and play golf in the off season. And I'm talking Bamberger and Fry, coaches, and Earl Weaver and Ralph Salvan, the trainer, and Dave McNally and people like that. We had some great moments. And, you know, Paul was a very competitive guy, and he had a tendency in the middle of Earl's backswing, talking about Earl Weaver, he would start moving, and Earl would call him out. And I always thought I had a love-hate relationship, but that certainly brought out the best in Earl.
Jim, that was an awful humbling thing that you just said about not getting to Cooperstown without Paul Blair, and we Oriole fans appreciate that. We can feel that love.
Well, you know, it's part of a very special era. And I mentioned we both came up in 1965. And one of the first things, and Paul certainly learned this as I did, and Brooks knew it because he not only, you know, had a restaurant, had come to the Orioles in the late 50s. If you're going to live in a town, you want to become part of it. And Paul Blair did a great job of doing that. And, you know, he'll just be missed. And, I mean, it's just hard to have people leave your life. You know, you think you play baseball, you become friends, your teammates, and then you figure they'll be around as long as you are. So he'll be missed greatly. And, you know, for all his friends and fans, I certainly hope they'll hang in there during the holiday season. This is not the way it's supposed to happen between Christmas and New Year's.
No, it's not. Jim Palmer, we really appreciate you sharing your thoughts today on the passing of Paul Blair. Thank you.
You're welcome. Happy holidays, everybody.
Hall of Famer Jim Palmer on Maryland's News Now.